Welcome to the Live Up podcast, where we watch the movies from our youth to see if they live up. Quick note on how this will go. We will review, discuss, and score the movie in question and see how it lives up to us now as adults and how it could live up to kids today. Also, listeners, new listeners, make sure to follow us, subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, leave a review, and talk about how awesome we are. That helps a lot. I'm Jess Latiman.
And I'm Amanda Treat. The magic of the holidays continues. We're ending 2023 with one final review of a Christmas movie because this is a Christmas
movie. Hells yeah, it is.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. It's 1988's Die Hard.
Even though that was in the script, the yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker still made me laugh.
Yeah, Jess almost spit out her drink there. Since we're talking about movies that we watched in our childhood, Jess, did you actually watch this as a kid?
I did. I watched this a lot. Definitely come this time of year. I think this was in rotation as much as It's a Wonderful Life in our house. It was also a movie that my brother and I were like eager to agree on to watch. I definitely watched it on TV primarily because I remember watching it with all the dubbed over curse words. So the whole yippee-ki-yay motherfucker line didn't really come into my consciousness until later.
Did they say something else? Like yippee-ki-yay motherfather?
I don't know. I don't remember. I think I remember the yippee-ki-yay, but the motherfucker, maybe there was just yippee-ki-yay mother bleep. I don't know. But I mean, I watched this a ton. I think my brother and I would watch Die Hard, then Die Hard 2 in a row, like all the time during this time of year. And I feel like very specifically, it's a movie we watched when we were home from school between Christmas and New Year's. Like all the, it must have been on TV all the time.
Oh, for that vacation period.
Yeah, I feel like I watched, because I do remember watching both movies in succession all the time. And when do I have time to do that?
I'm picturing you and your brother sitting on the couch, a cup of hot chocolate with the marshmallows, watching people get murdered. That's so cozy.
So cozy. It was so nice. So I watched this movie with my daughter, Lily, who's 11. I hesitated a little bit because she didn't really like Indiana Jones. I know these are totally different movies. So I didn't think she would like it. But again, just like Prince of Thieves, I was like, oh, this is Snape's first role, movie role. I think you'll like him in this. And it was kind of fun to talk to her about how This is the character I thought of, and Prince of Thieves, Sheriff of Nottingham, where I was like, yes, Alan Rickman's going to play Snape. And I feel like she finally understood that, like the chronology of it, of just knowing him from this movie and then finding out he gets cast as Snape in Harry Potter. So she was excited about it. And then while we were watching and chatting about the movie, she just referred to Hans as Snape.
Yeah. Well, actually, so I want to pause for a second, because I don't think I realized till I was digging in, doing a little research for this episode, that this literally is Alan Rickman's first movie. He'd done some TV stuff, he'd done a lot of theater, but this was the premiere of Alan Rickman on the silver screen. And I read all these comments that he had just arrived in Hollywood, auditioned a few days into his arrival, got cast in this role, and was basically like, no, I don't want to be typecast as a villain. I don't want to be in an action movie. That he was worried about being typecast as a villain, and boom, look what happened. He is the best villain.
The best villain. And
definitely typecast as a villain, but the best villain.
And you can't tell me that this role is not, and Prince of Thieves, this role probably got him the Sheriff of Nottingham role, which then got him the Harry Potter role. Like, 100%. Yeah,
these movies were only 3 years apart, so absolutely Hans Gruber is on the radar of anyone who's casting at that point. Like, oh, we need a really cool, energized villain.
Who could be unhinged at times.
Yeah, we need slightly unhinged, but like, smart and clever. Yeah, Alan Rickman.
For the parents out there listening, there was definitely some satisfaction of, more so than Prince of Thieves, but maybe both together, of having your kid understand the chronology of when you experienced an actor and just understanding that they're not just the character they know them for. There's like a weird like satisfaction for all the old people out. And I felt old as fucking dirt saying this to Lily about
yes,
this.
You're basically teaching her evolution.
I am.
The cells divided, and then the fish grew legs and crawled out of the water, and then Alan Rickman starred in his first movie as Hans Gruber.
Exactly. Well, did you...
So good.
Did you watch this with your siblings when you were younger?
I want to say no. I have no idea if I saw this as a kid or really? Not. Like, it's just there in my consciousness, but I'm I surprised. Might not have seen this till I was an adult. I have no idea.
Really?
Like, it just was always there. It's like I absorbed every detail and plot point from this movie just through pop culture. Like, osmosis, I absorbed Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, and... It's just like, where did that come from? I have no idea. It's just always been there. I've definitely seen this before. This isn't my first viewing, but I have no idea when I first watched this.
So you probably haven't watched it as much as I have, I would venture to
probably
guess.
Not. I mean,
you were busy watching Rudolph and Babes in Toyland during this time.
I was, yeah. I had to watch those 100 times. This movie, this may have been my second viewing. It might have been my 10th. I have no idea how many times I've seen this movie.
Crazy.
It's just like part of my brain. It's like I downloaded it as part of the Matrix, you know, like
it's part of
absorb Die Hard. All right, got it, go move on. So this movie is like super 80s, and just all the pop culture references of the 80s are just flowing out of this movie. I mean, the shot of John crawling through the ducts, or even just saying the Nakatomi Corporation. Like, people instantly know what building you're talking about, what movie you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
This is our childhood. Plus, for some reason, the principal from The Breakfast Club is
in this.
You
know, I forgot he was in this.
He's dressed exactly the same as he was in The Breakfast Club. Like, I think he took his outfit from that and just wore it onto the set of this. And he's acting exactly the same as he did in The Breakfast Club. So that's just, it's a big 1980s blur in this movie.
Yeah, there's also a lot of shoulder pads. Like, as far as the eye could see in the holiday party, there's smoking in airports.
Oh, my favorite is when he just casually brings his gun on the plane.
I know.
Don't worry, I'm a cop.
I know. Yeah, and I think...
Like, how many people are packing on this flight? Like, what?
I know.
You can't bring a gun on a plane.
I know. And there are some pre-9/11 kind of elements to this. I thought it was very 1980s for the LA people to kind of sneer at John McClane being a New York City cop. There's something like... They sneer at it as if it's like some sort of low-class version of a cop.
This coastal rivalry.
Yeah, it's very like pre-9/11 to me. Like, this is before the time where they were selling like NYPD shirts in Times Square. So yeah, I just thought that was kind of, that to me also screamed 80s, you know?
Well, we've seen this in other movies, particularly Coming to America. Like, New York City was considered a shithole back then. And yeah, we'll have future movies. I can't wait to do Ninja Turtles coming in 2024 at some
future
point.
Episode.
It's very 1980s to be sneering at a New York City cop, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Even though this movie has just always been there and everybody probably just has it embedded in their souls, Jess, would you like to give a plot summary of Die Hard?
I would. Just in case, like Amanda, you don't even remember if you've seen it as a kid, but it's just embedded. But I think I'm going to try to do this in the style of a romantic comedy.
Ooh, a Hallmark Christmas
movie. Yes, a Hallmark Christmas movie, but make it Die Hard.
Oh.
Yep, that's where it is. actually, I'd love to see that.
Yes. Can we pitch that to somebody? I really want to see that on Hallmark.
Well, I think I'm going to pitch it right now. So in the shadow of his ex-wife's career, John McClane goes to extremes to demonstrate how competent he is at his job and realizes the mistakes he's made along the way. But is it enough to win back the love of his life? Oh, and his job is a New York City cop, and he has to save his wife and all her coworkers from a violent hostage situation, and lots of things blow up in the process.
It's so romantic.
So romantic. It's very... Yeah.
A merry C4 Christmas.
Will they or won't they? Yeah.
All right, get Hallmark on the phone. We are going to develop the script. And
yeah, you know, they might have done it already. Who knows?
They probably did, only, you know, it wasn't Nakatomi Plaza. It was like Candy Cane Tower or something stupid.
Don't bring a cookie factory into this, okay?
It's not set in L.A. It's set in Gingerbread Town, USA. Oh, my God. All right, so like a New York cop in an elevator, chef. Let's just dive in.
Let's do it.
Let's give a review of this movie. Now, we like to go character by character, and the main event here is John McClane, played by Bruce Willis, who, up until this point, was really just known as a comedic
Was
actor.
He really?
Yes, because he was big from that TV show Moonlighting.
Oh, that's right. No, I feel like we're too young for that.
We are. But yeah, that was like on the lighter side. And it was to such a point that when they started doing the previews for this movie, they had to downplay the fact that Bruce Willis was in it. Everyone thought it was going to be a comedy.
Well, I mean, it could have been.
They took him off the movie poster. Get out of here. Released it. Yeah. No, they really were like, this is a serious movie. We have named it Die Hard. It's so serious. Yeah, they just wanted everyone to know, like, this is going to be full of serious topics and explosions, and the fact that we cast a comedian in it. Or he's not a comedian, but yeah,
I guess it would be like, nobody took him seriously. It's like the dad from Modern Family or something was cast in some sort of action movie.
I mean, I feel like the modern equivalent is the fact that they put Bryan Cranston in Breaking Bad.
Oh, yeah, that's
you
right.
You know, like, he was on Seinfeld, and he was the dad on Malcolm in the Middle.
That's right.
Funny, 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 and then, oh my god, drug kingpin.
That's right, that's a good call.
Yeah. You gotta have some range,
yeah,
folks.
You do.
So, they nearly didn't cast Bruce Willis, but he does an awesome job. I don't know.
He's amazing.
I can't defend most of his other movies. We're not gonna kick him while he's down.
Yeah, that's true.
Been having tough times recently, but he's kind of flawless as this character in this role.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
So good.
So good. He feels like a very modern action hero, even to 2023 standards for me. Like, he's not just a shoot-em-up macho guy. Like, he's not a Rambo-type action hero.
No! And that's what he was being compared to coming, or the character.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got all your Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, you got your Schwarzenegger movies leading up to this, and those are really physical actors whose characters didn't have that whole, you know, there wasn't a backstory about the wife might be leaving him.
Right.
There wasn't any vulnerability, there wasn't any flaws really. It was just like, look at these tough guys who are unstoppable forces. And yeah, this is an actual human being portrayed here, doing some crazy, not human stuff, but we'll get into that in a little bit.
Yeah, I
no way you catch that vent from the elevator shaft.
Yeah, no way. Or maybe jump off the building while it's exploding, but somehow the rope you've tied or the hose you've tied yourself to doesn't also explode. That's okay. We accept the flaws of the action sequences.
We're granting this movie. Yeah.
But
it's a Christmas miracle.
But also, like, the way he does it and his character does it, he's not like, I know exactly what to do. I mean, essentially he does, but he's like kind of grumbling as he's doing it. He's like, oh crap, what do I have to do now? And there's something super relatable about that. He's like uber competent, but he's not uber confident. And so there's something that is still appealing about it. Like, he's a modern day kind of manly man because he does all the like physical stuff, but he's not a real bull in a china shop about it. He's not an asshole about it. But he talks about how he loves his wife when he's like talking to Sergeant Powell on the radio, how he is sorry, how he's made mistakes, and he gives Sergeant Powell like a big hug at the end, which is very like modern. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's just those small little elements just to me made him more human. And I think made him stand up to time. Like, my daughter did not like Indiana Jones at all. She thought he was a real asshole. Really, really liked John McClane.
Okay.
Was kind of interested in his story because he has these other background kind of things. Yeah. Like, he messed up his marriage and he's sorry and he's sort of trying to be a helper. Like, my daughter still responded to that. She really liked him.
Well, I think your Hallmark Christmas Die Hard actually isn't too far off the mark here. Gotcha laughing. So I was reading that the screenwriter, or actually this went through a couple of rewrites. One of the screenwriters took this and was trying to get into the character and then I guess had a car accident or had some sort of situation in his own life and got to thinking, like, if I had just gotten in a fight and died at that moment and never got to go back and apologize, that would have been devastating. And so, like, that's written in there as the stakes for John McClane. He picks that fight with his wife about her changing her last name at the company, and they're fighting over her career and gets split up for a split second so she can go give a speech, and then in comes Hans Gruber and his guys, and he doesn't have that chance to stop the fight and make it right.
Yeah.
And so that's in there. It's not the full stakes of the movie, clearly, because there are guys running around with C4 and a lot of people get shot. But for John McClane, he's trying to fix his marriage, and if he doesn't have the chance to talk to his wife again and dies without saying all those things, like, that's the stakes for him, is that he dies without fixing it.
Yeah.
So I thought that brought a lot more human a lot more human characteristics to a movie that otherwise could have been a really stupid shoot 'em up.
It could have been really stupid shoot 'em up, and it kind of wasn't. Yeah. But he also has, like, he has the right attitude. Like, he's like, you know, when he gets on the phone with the chief or the radio with the chief of police, who's like the principal from Breakfast Club, but who's obviously like a total douchebag. And Bruce Willis is like, who the fuck is this? Like, he definitely still has that disrespect for authority that is still kind of funny.
The opportunity that they have to put all of the good guys, the bad guys, the cops, the like assholes, everybody's on that same radio frequency talking to each other. And just some of the dialogue coming out of there is so funny. Like, this movie doesn't deserve to be as funny as it actually is, especially with a name like Die Hard. I'm gonna keep going back to the title. It sets you up thinking this is gonna be a stupid movie with that title, and there's so much more depth to it. It's great. It's so good.
It's so good. It is funny. And even, you know, I think folks who don't remember this from the movie, because I kind of forgot this too, that he takes his shoes off. I know this is an iconic thing where the John McClane character takes his shoes off. So he's like squishing it in the carpet or something. And then he basically had to proceed to do the whole sequence of like the action sequence, and he's barefoot. And that just kind of becomes like part of his shtick. But again, it kind of humanizes him. He gets like a little grumbly about it. He's like, ooh, ouch, ouch, ouch. Kind of like...
Well, he's walking on glass.
Right.
Quite a bit.
Right. But I think it's...
That hurts.
But it kind of adds to him. It adds to the whole thing in a way, but not in a dumb way.
Yeah, he's not superhuman. Glass will cut his feet open.
Yeah.
Speaking of him with the bare feet, I watched this with my husband. He doesn't normally like the movies that we choose for this podcast, but he sat in for this
one. No surprise.
And I got that running commentary that only he can provide. And his first comment in that scene where you're watching Bruce Willis scrunch his toes, John McClane scrunch his toes against the carpet, and he... looks at me and goes, that is a bathroom with wall-to-wall carpeting. And he's barefoot in the bathroom.
Gross.
And like, you're putting like a fuzzy carpet in a bathroom? That is disgusting. That is the last place you want to be barefoot.
That's so true.
And now I can't unsee that.
Oh my God, I didn't even occur to me. That's gross.
Yeah. People, design tips for your home or your office or your home office. Do not put wall-to-wall carpeting in the bathroom.
Certainly.
There's just a lot of particles floating around that you don't want to be scrunching your toes in.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Disgusting. So disgusting. There's just some lines that, you know, like John McClane is a man of few words most of the time. Oh, actually, I take that back. He monologues into that radio quite a bit, but...
I kind of like his monologue. He's sort of like talking to himself, but not...
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny. Yeah.
But he's got some just quick under his breath quips that like my favorite is when he arrives at his wife's office and he meets that character who's kind of like a one of the Trump sons, isn't he?
That's so good. Yeah, he's definitely a Trump son.
Yeah, so you walk in on Ellis apparently doing a line of coke off his wife's desk. And then the scene proceeds, and halfway through it, John McClane just points at his face and goes, missed some. And I love that line so much. It's just such a passive-aggressive, like, get the F out of here, Ellis. Oh, that's such a funny line. But yeah, there's just little details like that where he's just coming up with a one-liner at the perfectly right moment. And some of those were ad-libbed, which I really appreciate.
Well, I guess if he started in comedy, I mean...
Yeah. I mean, the famous Yippee-ki-yay line, that was an ad-lib. That wasn't in the script.
Right, yeah, that's an iconic line, and it still lands. It's kind of fun. Yeah.
John, being John McClane, who's flown across the country to be with his wife, let's talk about his wife.
Let's.
We've got Holly Gennaro McClane.
Dash McClane.
In parentheses, McClane. The actress playing Holly is Bonnie Bedelia, and I put it in my notes, but she doesn't use this as her stage name. Her full name is Bonnie Bedelia Culkin.
No way.
Which I feel makes this a little bit more of a Christmas movie.
Is she related?
Because she's Macaulay Culkin's aunt.
Get out. I did no fucking way.
It's a Christmas movie dynasty.
Oh,
the whole family. Christmas movies for everyone.
That's amazing.
Yeah, no, she's Macaulay Culkin's aunt.
Amazing. And so these movies are 2 years apart, meaning Home Alone is 1990. So within 2 years, two members of the family make...
Three members, because the little brother Karen, is also in Home Alone.
They're like in the canon of American Christmas movies. That's crazy.
The best Christmas movies ever. All the Culkins.
Insane. That's so funny.
Yes.
Oh, I had no idea. Good fun fact.
Yeah. So Holly is, I mean, you were describing her. She is the protagonist from a Hallmark Christmas movie. She's a very career-driven woman who doesn't have time for love. But also, she's a really well-rounded character.
We should score this whole thing from a romantic comedy point of view.
Yes. The romantic comedy, Die Hard. No, she's a great character. I like her a lot. She's tough. Like, she's no nonsense. She's professional. She isn't the damsel in distress, and there's just a lot of likable stuff. She holds her own, like her going head-to-head with John, arguing about their marriage, or even when she has to go into Hans Gruber at one point and negotiate with him, and she is great. She just says, factually, this is what we need. This is what you need to do to help us. And Hans Gruber seems to respect that and gives her everything she asks for.
Yeah, it kind of...
Except for releasing the hostages, right. But she doesn't actually ask for that. So
yeah, she's asking for reasonable things like bathroom breaks. I like that she's de facto in charge. Like, of course, because the CEO gets, you know... gets the axe, gets the bullet to the head, and then she's basically the leader.
The head of the...
Yeah.
Yeah. No one else... You can't put Ellis in charge. Oh, he's so coked up right now.
There would be a higher body count if Ellis was in charge. And so...
He'd be walking around just pointing at people, calling everyone Bubby.
Yeah.
Hey, Bubby. That line was ad-lib, too. That actor was like, I could make him douchier. Watch. Hold my beer. I can make this character so much worse. Hey, Bubby! Yeah, we're skipping ahead. It's Hart Bachter playing Harry Ellis. And
he's kind of douchey because he's
perfectly cringy.
Perfectly cringy. So perfectly he's cringy. Also hitting on Holly when he's negotiating with Hans. He uses like those funny lines and then he gets a bullet to the head. So
he just gets shot. It's a really great arc for this character. He came, he annoyed everyone, he got shot in the head. Great, great character.
Yeah, and there's no love lost there. And I have to say, that was memorable. I remember all of his scenes. You know, friend, I haven't seen this movie in 30 years. I'm like, oh, here comes this guy. And now I'm going to forever think of him as one of the Trump sons. But
he really is. Oh, yeah, the hair gel, the coke, and the attitude.
But getting back to Holly.
We should talk about what we like here. So I think we both... really like that the final act of violence in this movie is Holly punching the reporter in the face. That had been building the whole movie because you see this reporter, he's just in it for the scoop. He puts her kids on camera without asking permission, puts all of their lives at risk, and then she runs into him face to face at the end, and she just cold cocks that guy. Like, knocks him over.
Yeah, this is something...
Great shot.
Great shot. I loved that. It's something...
I didn't see it coming, too. And I, like, forgot that she does that at the end. And when she punched him, I was like, oh, hell yes. Yes, Holly.
Yeah, I forgot about that whole side plot. And I don't think I picked up on this as a kid. But basically, the reporter interviewing Holly and John's children essentially exposes who John is to Hans Gruber and the terrorists. So I did not realize that as a kid.
Yeah.
So he deserved that punch.
So, yeah, punch that guy in the face. He's a jerk.
He's definitely a jerk. Yeah, but he's not unhinged.
Not an actual villain, but he's kind of worse.
Kind of worse. But the actual villain, which I know we've talked about already because we love Alan Rickman.
Oh, my God. I feel like we need like a drumroll or some sort of entrance theme to even talk about Alan Rickman as Hans Gruber. What an entrance into this movie.
What an entrance.
You see the truck driving through the city. You don't even know what it means, but there's just every few scenes they're cutting away and you're just seeing this truck get closer and closer and closer. And when they get into the parking garage, the doors fly open. And this whole commando team almost... I'm calling them that. It's a bunch of guys who were cast to look like really big German dudes.
Yeah.
And none of them are actually German, which is hilarious. But yeah, I'm distracting myself here. The doors fly open. This whole team of villains walks out. And in the middle of it is Alan Rickman looking so slick.
Yeah.
In that suit. He's got his like duster jacket. It's just friggin' awesome. Movies have been great ever since he stepped off that truck and into our hearts. all-time greatest villain.
Into our hearts and then off the side of a building. But anyway, he has a great entrance. He's super smooth. He sort of plays it like Arsène Lupin, gentleman thief. You know, he talks about designer suits. He's calm.
I want to see his Ocean's 11.
Yes.
You know, he clearly thought through this whole heist. He's got, I mean, that scene where he walks through, he's got all the hostages from the Christmas party, and he's looking for Mr. Takagi, and he just recites this man's entire life history out loud, and not in, like, an insulting or demeaning way.
He's super cool about it. Like, he's yes. like, well, I expected the police to come. I expected this. Which makes him a little bit more unhinged. And a psychopath, because you're like, what is this guy? Again, similar to the Sheriff of Nottingham character, he's kind of capable of anything.
He is, but he's, rather than just like emotionally or with energy just flying off the handle unhinged, he is so calculated. Yeah. He's got that great line before he does it. He says, I'm about to count to three. There will not be a four.
That's a great line.
That's such a smooth line. Oh my God. And you're like a little scared, but you're like, oh, but this guy's... so cool.
Yeah. And he does it a few times in the movie. And by the second and third time, it was fun to watch, you know, because anything could happen. And it's like, it helps build the tension that there will not be a four.
I want to see like the prequel movie about them planning this heist where he's got all those guys in a room and he's got PowerPoint screen up like Danny Ocean does. Yeah. We're going to be hitting the Nakatomi Plaza. Our entry point is here. We're going to take out the guard there. We're going to do this. I mean... they execute a really good plan up until a point.
Right.
It's so cool. Like, I really do want to see the mechanics of this heist almost as much as I want to see it unfold and then get disrupted by John McClane.
It's very clever, and it still is clever 30 years later watching it. It's not predictable if you've never seen it before. I mean, seeing it through my kids' eyes, but also just seeing it again for a long time. I don't remember the details of how they get the safe open and what exactly Hans Gruber has planned and how calculating of a psychopath he is. It's still surprising in terms of how the heist unfolds and what he expects. And you're kind of wondering the whole time, why is he obsessed with the detonators and the bombs? And why did he get the hostages? And, you know, because at some point in the movie, I was like, well, is it a plot hole that it's Christmas Eve? But then no, the hostages had a purpose for him. Getting back to Alan Rickman's performance in this, because he's so cool and calculated, you really are on the edge of your seat.
Some of the moments I love about Hans Gruber is he's clearly thought this all through, but he invites the audience in on some of his like distractions and red herrings. Like there's that moment where he calls and pretends he wants all these terrorists released
from various
prisons around the world, which when he hangs up, he's like, no, I don't.
Right. And even one of the goons is like, well, who are those people? And he's like, I read about them in Time magazine. I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, he sends them on this wild goose chase. But now you, the audience, are like, yeah, that's pretty clever. That's like, true. You're in on his whole plot now, which is kind of fantastic. And yeah, you're watching him instruct his team, like, all right, we got to do this. And then we wait for that. And then we need the FBI to cut the power to get into the final vault. And they say that, and then soon after, you see the FBI cut the power to the building. You're like, Hans had that plan the whole time, but you're totally in the heist with him. That part's really
fun. Didn't you slightly want to, like, root for him just a little bit without the murder?
Yeah.
I kind of remember it as a kid, too, being like, wow, they're so close to getting away with this. They're so clever. And, you know, aside from all the murder.
I mean, if he'd gotten away and they'd kind of left it as like, now you have a nemesis, John McClane. I'll see you in Die Hard 2.
So good.
Die Hard 2 would have been a much better movie.
Although I like Die Hard 2, but that's okay. But I agree.
But with Hans Gruber, it would have been a much better
movie. It would have been. And there's just such a way that he plays. Alan Rickman has this special way of playing a psychopath that's so under the surface. Like, he plays it with his face. He talks really slowly. I mean, it's very similar in some ways to Sheriff of Nottingham's character, which he plays in Prince of Thieves. Although that one is a little bit flying off the handle.
He's so unhinged in that. I mean, he's taken...
but he's a psychopath
crazy
here, too.
To 11 on
I
that.
I mean, he's...
he is, but very different. It's a different type of psychopath. I mean, he's... Alan Rickman has a psychopath range. And it's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
But even the moments where when John McClane is telling Sergeant Powell over the radio that if he doesn't make it, to tell his wife he's sorry and all this, and Hans comes in and is like, that's touching, but...
Yeah, no, and it's just so cool. Yeah.
And I really believe this, that in the hands of anybody else, he would just be a comic book level villain. He wouldn't be as compelling. Yeah. And 30 plus years later, he's still really compelling. He's still a good villain.
Oh, yeah.
It all kind of, he holds your attention still. He held my daughter's attention, even though she was like referring to him as air quote Snape all the time. But I do think that that's cool too, because you could see the transition as an actor. This is why he was great in Harry Potter too, because he has this great range. He's not a pure villain.
His psychopath. Yeah. His psychopath range.
His psychopath. Alan Rickman's psychopath
range. His psycho spectrum.
So good.
It's still there. And I was kind of worried it would, because I was building it up in my mind. I was so excited to see this again. And I was like, oh no, what if Alan Rickman is really just terrible and his lines are cheesy? But that is absolutely not the case. It's it's like a time capsule. It's exactly as you remember.
See, I had almost weirder worry coming in. I always hold up The Dark Knight as an example of where the villain outshone the hero much. Yeah. Like, I just wanted Batman to get off the screen. Like, go back to Heath Ledger. I need to see what the Joker's doing right now. And so I was worried because I've seen my share of not that great Bruce Willis movies over the years. And so my worry was like, oh my God, is this going to be one of those movies where I just want Hans Gruber back on the screen and I don't care about John McClane? And it wasn't. So that is kudos to both of those actors, that they were really well balanced. There's like, they're really good counterparts to each other. I think the two of them are ad-libbing a bit of stuff here too. So just both of them are bringing their A game to this movie. It's awesome.
It is awesome in this level of scripting. And this is what I kind of was thinking about, you know, as I'm sitting there with my daughter watching it, in terms of the violence in the movie. And I think this is just how, it's both how Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman play their characters, but it's also in how the movie's made, is that these characters have, there's violence, but it's with precision. It's with a purpose. And I think about what bothered me about Indiana Jones. I know I had my pearls clutched, people. I got a lot of hate mail for
she
it.
She did.
That she I did. Didn't, like, I...
The internet did not appreciate Jess's take on Indiana
did
Jones.
Did not at all. But I didn't really like violence without a purpose, and I still kind of don't. Like, just mowing people down or just killing the brown guys who just happened to be in the way, which was a definite hallmark of Indiana Jones. I feel like in this case, the violence was precise. You understand Hans's goal. So yes, he's a psychopath and he's like counting to three before he shoots people, but you kind of get why he's doing it. And then for Bruce Willis, yeah, he is like shooting up things. He's shooting glass. He's blowing up the lobby to try to save people. I mean, there's a lot of violence there, but it's all with a purpose of self-defense. He even throws a goon out the window to make sure it crashes on the police car down below so he could basically call for help.
Yeah.
But it all had a purpose. And so none of it really bothered me. It wasn't gratuitous.
In the 80s, that's how we had to send tweets. You had to throw a body out the window onto a windshield. Yeah. And then
that's your hashtag 911.
Hopefully that got a thumbs up at the bottom there.
Yeah. And I was even like, again, it's a focus group of one, but my daughter tolerated the violence here in a way, and she does for Star Wars and stuff. We certainly watch violent things. This is making me sound like a terrible parent. But I think she tolerated this more than Indiana Jones because it all made sense in the plot.
Yeah, there's order to it rather than...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just like chaotically, randomly shooting and killing people.
Yeah.
Although this viewing, because I haven't seen this probably in a couple of years, I forgot how quickly John McClane shows his hand. So he's up in that abandoned floor of the building that every 1980s building had. We reviewed that in Adventures in Babysitting. The top floor is always under construction and there's always a battle being fought up there. That's just how it was in the
80s. I guess it is. All these unfinished buildings with parties going on below.
Yes, and there's always a party going
with
on
lots of shoulder pads.
He goes head to head with one of the henchmen and it's that very iconic, now I have a machine gun, ho ho ho, throwing the guy down the elevator.
Yeah.
And that came on so quickly for me, this viewing, cause in my head it was like he's really running and hiding from this group of I guess they prefer to be called thieves and not terrorists. Right.
Yeah, be either be way. Correct phrasing here.
Yes. So he's trying to hide himself from the thieves so he can get the message out. There's a hostage situation going on at the Christmas party. And he doesn't need to show that guy's body so quickly, but he just goes for it. It's like, opportunity to write a message on a shirt. This was the other way of tweeting. And then,
oh yeah, 80s but kids. I think you had to write the message in their blood.
Yeah. And then Hans Gruber takes the rest of the blood and like, retweet, and then send the elevator back up to the top floor. This is totally how we did it.
Definitely. All you have to do is break a goon's neck. It's fine.
Yeah. It was the time and the place. Yeah. I wasn't expecting that to happen so quickly. Like, that was more like the middle of the movie in my mind.
Mine too. And
it's right in the beginning.
It's right in the beginning. It's the cat and mouse starts right away. I had even forgotten the whole side plot of Hans Gruber's character sort of separating from the group and running into Bruce Willis and then pretending that he's a hostage. And he like busts out with an American accent.
And that's an interesting American accent, but you know what? All right.
I'll allow it.
An English guy playing a European, supposed to be German, except... So yeah, none of those actors are actually German, and they were just speaking gibberish the
whole time. Oh, really?
That's
hilarious.
Making it sound German. Yeah. And then I've heard they've redubbed some of their, like, some versions have a redub.
Oh, it's actually
Germans
in German.
Are actually speaking over them, but the mouths don't align. I don't think I was watching that version. I think they were just like... like just marbles in your mouth.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, some of the actors were Russian, some of them were American. They were just all cast because they looked like they were big German dudes.
That's funny.
That aside, Alan Rickman's American accent is not good.
It's not.
I don't know where he's getting that from, but like he kind of gets away with it, like in the movie.
Yeah, I'm going to allow it because he's so good elsewhere. In the movie, this is not Kevin Costner phoning in an American savior version of Robin Hood.
No. This is not a British savior accent.
No, it is, not. And, you know, because at the time he's also he's knowingly pretending to be an American. Like, in some ways it sort of tracks that the accent wouldn't be perfect.
So that whole scene did not rehearse that at all. And those two actors had not been paired up in any of the scenes prior. Like, they're talking in the walkie-talkie or the radio back and forth to each other. But they just threw Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman together and say, okay, you two are going to talk a little bit and then he's going to get a gun and then the gun's not going to be loaded. Go.
Yeah.
And they just made up the whole thing on the spot. They did that on purpose to make both of the actors seem like they're kind of winging it a little bit. It's a little bit awkward.
Oh, that's interesting.
That also may be part of the reason Alan Rickman's accent is not quite a thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just almost an entirely improv scene, which is awesome.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize it was improv, too. You kind of forget that they actually don't have that, aside from then the final standoff at the end. That's their only other scene together where they're in the same physical presence. And you kind of forget that. That's how good the movie is stitched together. I guess it speaks to the editing and the scripting. And it's still really great.
Yeah, they barely cross paths on set or otherwise. Yeah. And we were talking about Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins having that situation where they weren't really acting in the same room together for most of that movie. But yeah, same thing here. You totally forget that they're not face-to-face for most of this movie.
You know, Hans Gruber is sort of like, he's not like Hannibal Lecter-level psychopath, but he has that same calmness
the eerie. It's an eerie calm.
It's an eerie calm that, like, it definitely, like, puts you on edge as the viewer. Because you're just like, this guy could do anything.
And I think that's why the scene where Holly goes in and says, hey, we have some requests for you. Initially, you're on the edge of your seat. Like, he could do anything right now.
I know. Another way I think that it's so well constructed, the villainy. So I split watched this over two nights and Lily was like, oh, I just really want to see what happens. Like, she was genuinely, she's like, does he live at the end?
Tune in tomorrow.
Cause she was, this also speaks to, like, you know, the unhinged villain, like anything could happen. Yeah. And I think the fact that she was like, not sure it was going to work out for the good guy, you know?
Yeah. Well, so we should talk about some of the other characters real quick. So you have Mr. Takagi, who's played by James Shigeta, and he's the boss, and he's a very reasonable boss. And the second John McClane walks into the building, he's that type of leader who he knows instantly who John mm-hmm. McClane is. It's like, oh, your wife is over there. I know everything that's going on, everybody in this building, but not in a creepy way. It's like a, I do all my research because this is how I run my business. He's a very likable character, even as the boss. And the fact that Hans Gruber's going to count to three and there will not be a four and just offs him so quickly. Like, it just, at that moment, you're just thinking, oh no, Hans Gruber's going to kill everybody.
Right? Yeah, you have that moment where like,
like, oh, I really shit. Like all these characters.
Except for Ellis.
Not yeah. Ellis. I don't like Ellis.
There's one funny thing that when he's, well, there's two funny things, and now seeing it again, and I, of course, you know that Takagi gets it, but, yeah. You know, when Hans is talking about how he has such a nice suit, you definitely have the undertone of like, oh, it'd be a shame to get, you know, your blood and brains all over that suit.
There's a bit of that, but you also have the sense that Hans is, you know, a man of fashion and knows exactly how much the materials for that suit and probably knows right. who produced it, you know, like, oh, you have this tailor that you, just seems so meticulous.
So meticulous.
Meticulously psychotic.
But there's one funny thing in the background of like, yeah, the whole, it's sort of shocking as a viewer when Takagi gets killed. He's sort of set up as like he could be like a main character in the movie. But there's this funny thing where like the two goons, it's like Carl, the blonde, and Theo, the techie, nerdy bad guy mm-hmm. in the background, where they clearly have a bet going. There's no dialogue, but they clearly have a bet going as to whether Takagi gets killed or gives up the codes for whatever they need for the safe.
I didn't notice that. What did you
they're
pick
sort
up?
Of talking to each other in the background, and they're rolling their eyes as Hans and Takagi are having their scene. And then after Hans kills Takagi, Carl like rolls his eyes and hands $20 to Theo.
Oh, I didn't pick up
it's
on that
so
at all.
Funny.
Oh, that's funny.
I didn't pick up on that as a kid, but I, you know, oh. It's really funny to see it going on in the background because they don't, it's totally wordless.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
It's like gross, but funny.
Yeah. I completely missed that. Like all these viewings, whether it was two viewings or 10.
Well, the other fun detail with the goons that Lily and I both appreciated is like when the SWAT team's about to come in. And one of the goons, like, sets up behind, like, a little shop counter. And he's like,
I love that.
He's, like, looking at the candy bars. And he's just looking at it. And then each scene that you cut to him, he's, like, opening the case of the candy bars. And then at some point, you just see him later just eating the candy bar.
He's sitting there with an open candy. Yes.
And what's funny about that is that an entire, like, SWAT team gets demolished and the lobby gets blown up. But, like, they continued on the candy bar story throughout the... Which is really fun. Again, it's wordless.
Pulling off a very violent heist, but, you know, candy.
Candy, yeah.
And also the look on his face like, well, you shouldn't steal.
I know.
But also, we're here to steal millions. So,
like, I shouldn't take this
okay.
$1 candy bar, probably a quarter
in
the
80s. I shouldn't take it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that got a laugh yeah. out of Lily because we both thought that was funny.
We've talked about some of the other side characters, but I think the one other major person we need to talk about is Sergeant Al Powell, mm-hmm. played by Reginald Vell Johnson, who went on to be Carl.
Oh, that's right. On yeah.
Family Matters. I was about to say Modern Family. I was like, nope, wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I watched that religiously.
The Urkel yeah. show. Yeah, he was on the Urkel show. He's like the good cop. He's the ultimate helper character, and he and John are kind of doing therapy with each other in front
are.
Of everyone on that radio.
Yeah.
This part seemed a little bit forced. I mean, they were rounding him out a little bit, but they explain that he is more of a desk jockey cop now because he accidentally shot a kid. They don't dwell on that too much, but that he doesn't like using his firearm
yeah.
anymore. And then at the end of the movie, and I saw your note, I thought this was stupid too. You basically have a zombie henchman come back from the dead after they've blown up the whole building and killed everyone.
Yeah.
And you finally get Al whips out his gun, shoots that guy, and saves the day. I didn't need that whole subplot.
I didn't either. Because it was already enough. They already had like a good bromance going. You didn't have to...
They did.
Do any heroics.
You don't have to shoot a zombie.
Yeah.
Thief, zombie.
Didn't need it.
Terrorist. Whatever their preferred term is.
Yeah.
He did look like a zombie.
He did. And there's no way. And this is the Carl yeah. character. And like in the action sequence leading up to this, basically he gets inadvertently hanged by a chain after he and Bruce Willis are fighting. Like, it's just not a survivable
thing. Yeah, it didn't look like he'd be walking out of that building.
And he certainly wouldn't still be holding his semi-automatic weapon. So,
no.
It's, you know, that I didn't really need. That to me is like the Rambo type thing that got added into the script that was just not needed. I prefer my Hallmark version of Die Hard, that with that, I didn't need that.
Al was already a great character. He doesn't need to be the hero at the end of this thing. Especially since it then cuts to Holly punching that reporter in the face.
Yeah.
Like, let that moment shine. That would have been fun.
But another punch in the face I liked is the limo driver. At some point, he's basically trapped in the garage, but doesn't realize it for most of the movie.
Yeah, he's just talking on the phone, goofing off, drinking.
He's drinking all the liquor in the limo, and then he has a great redemption, or a great moment at the end, where he essentially stops Theo, one of the bad guys, who's trying to like set up their escape. He like crashes the limo into him and then socks him in the face. It's pretty good.
It is, although I feel like that ultimately wouldn't have caused enough damage to stop him
if True.
Theo really wanted to get out of there. But yeah, we'll just suspend our disbelief here.
You know, that also elicited laughs from Lily, because it was like, okay, there was some sort of, that doesn't mean that it would for every kid, but I laugh too, because it's kind of the comic relief. It's sort of fun that even the limo driver gets in on the action and punches someone in the face.
Yeah. So I was reading that originally this was going to be like 90% John McClane and every other character, including Holly, including Argyle the limo driver, including Sergeant L. Powell, that they were all much smaller characters with less lines, and that Bruce Willis literally had scheduling conflicts with shooting Moonlighting.
Oh, okay.
So he requested they give those characters more screen time so that he could go film his TV show.
Oh, that's so funny.
And then come back. And it's so much better for it. All these other characters are so much more well-rounded. Debatably Argyle. He's a little bit goofy and doesn't do a whole lot.
For young kids watching this rated R movie, and I think even my son, I did not watch this with my six-year-old listeners, just to clarify, I think my wife would have murdered me for that, but I'm sure he would have laughed at Argyle's like ineptness a little bit.
He's not murdering anyone. It's very low stakes in the limo, but yeah.
It was also an opportunity for me to be an old person again and talk to Lily about how much I like old school hip hop better than current day hip hop.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, this is the good stuff.
There's this great scene where John McClane, they're driving in the limo. John gets in shotgun instead of sitting in the back of the limo. Because I guess he's, you know, such a salt of the earth cop. So they're driving along and he asks him to put some Christmas music on, and Argyle's got Run DMC. Oh, God, which song was that? It's their Christmas song. And
I loved it.
Just quips. He's like, this is Christmas music. And you don't recognize it immediately. And then you're like, oh, no, it's that Run DMC Christmas song. But I'm sure at the time it was brand new. And
yeah, I'm sure it was.
Sounds like random Run DMC.
Yeah.
That is the good rap music right there, guys.
It's like the original. I love it.
For us old folk. I know. Yeah. So, yeah, just overall with this movie, I was watching it with my husband, so there was just this, like, running commentary.
I like running commentary from Jeremy. It's good.
Oh, yeah. There's that moment where John McClane throws the explosives down the elevator shaft, trying to alert the police, like, we have an actual problem in here. And I just hear after that scene my husband muttering, there wasn't enough CF4 to make an explosion that big. Like,
is he an expert?
Okay, honey. Okay, yeah, honey. Like in your professional opinion of never having handled C4. But other things that are cool. So this is a Michael Kamen soundtrack. He also did Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves,
that's right.
Which is an epic soundtrack. Like, he's just really awesome at composing. So the Ode to Joy that keeps playing, the Beethoven's Ode to Joy, anytime Alan Rickman comes sashaying through. But, you know, it's kind of like the theme song for The Terrorists. Michael came and read that in the script and was like, no, 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 no. We are not putting Beethoven in an action movie. How dare you? You know, like it was a sacrilege. Don't you dare do this to Beethoven. And the director had to say to him, they used it in A Clockwork Orange. Will you give this a pass? And so he wrote the soundtrack and kept working different versions of Ode to Joy in it. Like, the moment they open the vault, the bad guys open the vault and get the money that they were after the whole time, that scene is so celebratory and looks so cool. You know, they got what they accomplished, but they're playing Ode to Joy so loud, and it just, it works so well. So I think
I didn't notice.
You don't notice the soundtrack the whole time because they're blowing up so much stuff, but it's a really good soundtrack. Michael Kamen's awesome. So yeah, I thought that was a really cool detail that they had to fight with him about whether we use the Beethoven or not in Die Hard.
Die Hard.
Don't do it. Don't do that to Beethoven.
Yes, do it. Make it a classic.
So you have heard me a few times mention how I think one of the dumber things about this movie is the title. Yeah.
It's a dumb title.
Not, if you literally think about it, like it's like Tarzan wrote the title of this movie, Die Hard. Like, that's not a sentence. That's not a description of anything.
Right.
And then it doesn't translate. We were talking about Christmas movies at work the other day, and I have a lot of French colleagues. And the person who brought this up knew to call it Die Hard, but I was looking and it's called like Piège de Cristal, which means the crystal trap. In French.
That sounds like... I don't even know what that sounds like. That makes no sense.
It's just as dumb as Die Hard. It doesn't make any less sense. It's, I guess, the crystal trap. They're talking about the bills.
I guess. Is it like the glass trap? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of glass being shot around in that movie. But yeah, this just sounds like a grunt of a movie title.
Yeah.
It's really stupid, and this movie doesn't deserve to be as good as it is for a title that's stupid.
We should think about what the Hallmark version of a Hallmark Christmas movie, but make it Die Hard, would be. What would the title be? Would it be like Kidnapping My Way Into Your Heart?
Ooh.
I don't know. I feel like there's a good title in there that might actually be more descriptive.
Oh my God. All right. We're going to... The pun gears in my brain are turning here. Because, you know, Hallmark movies, everything's about, you know, you gotta name it like Snowflake Lane. And, you
know. I know.
It's probably called The Crystal Trap.
It probably is.
Hallmark Channel.
Oh my God. It could be Tara, Save My Marriage.
That was a different movie. Do you remember Dennis Leary's The Ref?
Yeah, that's right. Oh yeah, my God, you're right.
That's a not terrorist, but that's a thief saving my marriage.
Yeah.
We might have to do that. That.
Another plug for a future
episode. We were kids
episode.
When that came out. The original script, this was supposed to take place over the course of 3 days. Mm. So it was a 3-day hostage situation. And they've condensed it all down just to Christmas Eve in the version.
Well, this makes it a Christmas movie now.
We all know enough. It would have gotten a lot grosser and sweatier, and that bathroom carpet would have been even funkier.
Yeah, all of his cuts in his feet would have gotten infected.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The hostage There's that was no... pregnant would have given birth. It's better to keep it all one night because it sort of adds to like keeping the plot moving.
I don't want to say it makes it more realistic because that... There's a lot of not realistic things going on in this movie. The aforementioned fall down the elevator shaft, quick grab onto the vent. Like, no, nobody would stick the landing on that. I don't think a person who weighed 50 pounds could catch themselves at the speed that he was falling down that elevator shaft.
You know, I kind of forgive it because some of it's so iconic. He's such a believable character that I'm okay that he jumps off the roof tied to a hose as it's exploding. The one thing that I did notice, or just generally speaking, people walking in with machine guns to a workplace, it does land a little differently now. It doesn't land differently that makes it cringy or that you shouldn't watch it or anything.
It does feel like a time capsule.
It does, because my daughter noticed that and was like, oh, I don't really like that about this movie. Like she said afterwards, because, you know, she's grown up doing the active shooter drills in school. So there's just like a more, it hits a little different, but it's okay. It's like you kind of like realize it as it's happening that it feels different than when you watch it as a kid, and probably to an adult at the time in 1988. There is a small element of like, oh, okay, this does kind of date the movie.
So I used to jokingly pitch a movie. It was not a Hallmark Christmas movie, but like a thriller where Bruce Willis is pitted against Liam Neeson, and Liam has Bruce's wife as a hostage. Ooh. And won't release her because
crossover.
Bruce has taken Liam's daughter hostage.
What?
And then they spend the whole movie just threatening each other over the phone or over a radio, and then getting increasingly more violent. And yeah, just real cat and mouse, but they're both kind of the cat. Do you want to know the name of this amazing movie?
We're talking about titles.
Taken Hard.
Oh!
I used to float that out there to random when I was working in films. Nobody ever took me up on this.
I like it. Taken Hard. I like it.
Taken Hard.
Hilarious. It could definitely live in the Die Hard-like franchise, I think.
There would be so much violence and so much grumbling into that radio.
Yeah, I guess the word hard, that probably would make it weird if that was in the Hallmark title that we're trying to come up with.
I mean, it could just be called Die Hard, but a Hallmark movie. After Die Hard, that became a way of pitching so many action movies, like Die Hard, but on a bus. You know which movie
I'm talking
about.
I know exactly which movie you're talking about.
Because that's how they pitched it. Yeah. Die Hard, but on the Hallmark channel.
Oh, yeah. So good. I can't wait to watch that one day. The one thing I'll say, just like in the category of what I find good about this movie, I know we talked about the violence, but I think the action sequences, we've picked it apart a little bit, but generally speaking, the action sequences and the fight sequences are really good. They're still really good. They're well choreographed. They're not unrealistic. They don't go on endlessly as I think some Marvel fight sequences do. They're just long enough to make the point and be intense. And there's a little bit of gore, but not too much. It's, I think, like a perfect balance action sequence kind of a movie.
Yeah.
So are we ready to rate Die Hard / The Crystal Palace? Or no, The Crystal Trap.
The Crystal Trap.
I even got the French title wrong. To remind listeners or new listeners, so we rate on a 1 to 10 scale for adults and then kids. The scale is the same. 1 is garbage and 10 is Princess Bride. And we typically start with adults. I did peek at some previous ratings, but what do you think, Amanda, for an adult rating?
I'm doing this on the fly because I actually didn't think about it ahead of time.
I could go first.
Why don't you go first?
Wow, what happened to the Order Muppet Amanda? So, man, it's like...
I'm feeling put on the spot. You go.
I'm putting too much pressure on Amanda. So I gave it a 7. Because I thought it was wildly enjoyable to watch again. There wasn't too much new that I got out of it in terms of a new appreciation. There was a little bit of stuff, but it's exactly as is. And I thought that was great. So I gave it a 7.
Oh, I'm very torn on this because it did surpass my expectations, as you've heard me say. I think I'm going to go as high as an 8.
Yeah, that's right. That's fair. Yeah.
It was a lot of fun to rewatch it, and it was better than I remembered. And oh my god, Alan Rickman is just so freaking cool.
Still so cool.
Yeah.
It's great. So that's a 15 for our adult rating, which is on the high end for us.
It's tied with the Addams Family and the Muppet Movie for our adult ratings.
All right. Okay. I think that's good company. So our kid rating. So does this live up to kids or the intended audience? And the intended audience.
We need to define kids here. This movie is rated R. This isn't our first rated R movie. We did Coming to America by accident.
Right, but when you watched it, these rated R movies were on TV. They just dubbed bleeped all the curse words.
Yeah. Yippee-ki-yay, mother father.
It still cracks me up. I think I would put it as, I think you could go a little younger than tween for this. Like, my daughter was 11, and I thought that was totally fine. Mm-hmm. She knows not to repeat yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Yeah, actually, that's... You were talking before we started recording about your key concern.
Oh, yeah.
Showing this to a younger audience would be them thinking some of the expressions used in this movie are so cool.
Yeah.
That now you're getting phone calls from the teacher because... Your son went to school and told her, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Which would be amazing, but, yeah.
Like, you got an A on your spelling test. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Okay.
And you're going to the principal's office right now.
Now we have a problem.
Yeah, I think that for kids, that as a parent, that would be my primary concern, is it's not really the violence they want. You know, there's violence in a lot of kids' movies, even Disney movies. It's really like repeating the curse words, I think, would be a little tough for younger kids. So I think tween and even the younger side of tween would be okay. That's how I'm going to think about it. I think I probably started, so this movie came out in 88. So I probably started watching this movie at 9 or 10, and I think that's okay.
All right.
So same rating, 1 being garbage, 10 being Princess Bride. I'm going to go 7 again. So 7's across the board for me because I think it's well above average.
And I am a little bit influenced by like Lily's reaction and actual enjoyment of this movie.
I think I'm going to go 6.5 and hedge my bets here.
Yeah.
And I'm honestly doing lower than I probably should be because I'm looking at some of the scores we gave movies earlier
Cheating.
On. And I don't think we were weighting the scores for this just being a teen.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Or a tween target audience. So yeah, we gave some very low scores to, you know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, that score is off.
Coming to America. We shot a little low on those because we thought this isn't a kid's movie. Die Hard is not a kid's movie, but older kids would enjoy it. So yeah, 6.5. That's where I'm
I think
land.
It's right to weight it. We might have to address the ratings from earlier on. We might need to revisit that at some point. Because
we owe Roger Rabbit a do-over.
We do. I guess to defend our lower scores in some of those movies is that sometimes when there's just older references, it's harder for kids these days to follow along. So if they're referencing cultural things from the 80s or 90s.
It wasn't even a cultural thing. Roger Rabbit, they were sinking so deep into real estate law.
That's true.
Where we were. We probate were raising some flags. Like, yeah, kids don't know what probate
That's
is.
So true.
I don't know what probate is as an adult. Come on. Yeah.
What's our total?
We're at 28.5, which is one of our highest scores. We're rating this higher than the Disney Robin Hood. We're rating this lower than Edward Scissorhands, lower than Beetlejuice, lower than Beauty and the Beast.
Okay.
Lower than the Muppet movie.
Yeah, I think that's about right. So listeners, that's not the only thing. It's not just the score. We had, there's one more question. Does it live up? It's a yay or nay. Amanda and I both have to agree for it to live up. We have had split decisions before, which means it doesn't live up. So what do you think? Live up or not, Amanda?
I am voting everything about this lives up except for the stupid title.
It's so true.
But this movie lives up. The title does not.
Totally agree. I also think it lives up.
Hey!
Hey! So officially.
Merry Christmas, Die Hard. You live up.
Yeah. And I'm kind of relieved this lives up because we have had disappointments like Prince of Thieves and others, which are my fault. I know.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, you always bring that up.
I do, but the amount of times you've brought up Troop Beverly Hills, it's deserved.
Well, listeners, if you disagree, if you thought we were too generous, or maybe you agree but have some other criticism, get in touch with us at LiveUpPod on all the socials, at LiveUpPod on Gmail. Want to know if you agree with us? I assume you do. And go watch this movie. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.